It was a matter of going back over and over and over again. It was a matter of having gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer friends.
Right.
And one realizing, I'm nothing special. We all have our struggles and differences.
I'm just a postman. I'm just a postman. Oh, baby, I'm just a postman.
Hello
I'm
and welcome
just
to
a
H.A. Postman,
postman.
Season 2, Drawing Room Conversation, Episode 6 on Sexuality. I'm Madhav, and I'm now joined by my lovely, amazing co-hosts, Aditi and Indu. Our guest is East Pesel. Our guest just landed in India. Karim is a Mellon Ridge Assistant Professor in the Department of Theatre, Dance, and Performance Studies, teaching in Tufts University. Karim is super famous in the States and in India for his drag style. As a drag queen, he goes by Lahore, Rajasthan. If anyone can add spice to life, it's Karim. He teaches his students as Lahore, as a drag queen. We will use whatever we have today to unravel those awesome moments with Karim. And without further ado, please help me welcome Karim Khoobchandani. Thanks a ton for joining our show, Karim, and so sorry to put you through multiple Zoom links.
No, it's such a pleasure to be here. I'm so happy to see you again and to meet new folks, Aditi and Indu. Thank you for having me.
The feeling is mutual. So, Karim, there are multiple things that we would love to know about your journey and what you do. But I would want to start with the sexuality aspect of it as a childhood. As a child growing up in various parts of the world, could you take us through when did you realize your sexuality and how did that journey unravel for you?
I'm about empathy, love, and gratitude.
Sure. So I grew up in Ghana in West Africa. And I grew up in a Sindhi family there, and there's a fairly large Sindhi community there. And I went to an international school, but neither at home nor in school did anybody talk about LGBT identities, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender identities. So, my attraction to people of the same gender felt like an anomaly. It seemed very personal. I didn't have the language to name it. And I was at my cousin's house, and she was introducing me to the internet. So this was about 97, 98, where internet had first been installed in Ghanaian computers, and my cousin was one of the first people to get it. And she said, "Yeah, come and use it at our house." And so I went, and the first thing you did back then when you get to the internet is you make yourself an email address. And so I typed in hotmail.com, but I typed in HOTMALE.com. And suddenly there was all this gay porn on the screen. And it was very terrifying because my cousin was right there. So I like shut the computer off. But it also made me realize that there is this whole world and there's a whole language and there's a whole visual possibility that the way I felt and desired I wasn't alone, and that it wasn't just a slur, but that it was something that existed in multiplicity and looked different. And from there, I found things like erotic stories online, where I could just learn a little bit more and I feel a little bit less alone. When I came to the US in the year 2000 to start my undergraduate degree, that's where I found things like LGBT support groups. That's where I was further away from my family, so I could go online and, go on dates and go to bars and things like that, go to gay bars and parties and things like that, where I would meet more folks. It's where I joined activist groups in New York City, in upstate New York, and started dating and meeting other people and having sex. And so that's how it sort of grew. But it went from not having the language to talk about it to writing my undergraduate thesis on gay marriage and what it means for people in the U.S.
Right.
And so really, like, over 4 years, my life changed having access to a different kind of language to these things. I'll also say, you know, I went back to Ghana 2 years ago for the first time since I was 17 years old. And I met all these LGBT activists there. And I wish I had known that that was there then. You know, it's always been there. It's not like it wasn't there. I just was in my head thinking, I'm the only one, you know, and we never are the only one who feels different. We just have to find others like us. And there are many, many, many others.
Right. No, absolutely. I think that fear which you told me about accidentally pressing HR, mistyping it, and your cousins sitting right next to you, that feeling can be, it's like someone has snatched away your soul or someone has taken away your life. It's that scary. It can be that scary for a lot of people.
Yeah, it feels incriminating.
It does. And it's yeah, I'm getting chills right now as we speak. So, yes. At around what time did this transition happen? You became comfortable with the life, and how did that comfort or what rather drove you to doing the activism or being the professor, taking the academic life? Sorry. I'm about empathy,
love, and gratitude. Sure. You know, I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but I write about gay nightlife. But my first time at a gay nightclub, you know, which is supposed to be that time that is so exciting, and it's the place of escape and joy, and you finally have arrived as a queer person in this utopia. My first time at a gay bar was awful. It was so weird and strange and uncomfortable, and I was terrified to be there. It wasn't liberating, it wasn't freeing. It was a strange world that didn't look like anything I'd seen before. And this was when I was about 19 years old, in like a rural part of New York State. And so, you know, it was a matter of going back over and over and over again. It was a matter of having gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer friends.
Right.
And one realizing, you know, I'm nothing special. We all have our struggles and differences. And also, you know, what made me really comfortable was learning that there's actually a language to LGBT life, and that language being dress code and ways of talking and words we use and songs we like to listen to. There's a whole queer culture, and it looks different in every place, but that there are actual languages and cultures in which we get to be together and express together, that I not only started feeling comfortable, but I really fell in love with being queer, that I was learning these ways of being in the world that were fun and fabulous and spectacular and dangerous, and they weren't like just being a normal everyday person.
Right.
And, you know, I think that there's this desire for LGBT people to be, quote unquote, like everyone else. But to me, what I think is most exciting about being queer is that queer people have learned how to be better than everybody else, to make, and in that sense, I mean, to make the world much more interesting and exciting than everyday white bread.
Absolutely.
And so that's what I was seeing. That's what I was experiencing, you know, walking on the streets of Chelsea Piers in New York and going to clubs and watching drag shows and meeting butch dykes who wore leather and studs and rode motorbikes at the New York City Pride Parade. The Pride Parade always opens with dykes on bikes, who are these butch lesbians on motorbikes wearing leather, and they've got their femme girlfriends with them with their hair flying in the wind, and they're wearing rainbow. It's all so spectacular and beautiful. And I was like, why would I want to go back to wearing khaki pants and plain t-shirts when I could be like this? So with that, right. I developed a deep interest in nightlife cultures, and specifically South Asian nightlife, South Asian LGBT nightlife in New York City. Because I would go to New York and
of course,
go to these Bollywood parties where they were playing, they're playing all the songs that my parents and my brothers and cousins danced to at weddings.
Correct.
But it was, it was all drag queens and lesbian folks and queer folks dancing with each other, doing shows for each other. And it not only made me feel fabulous and wonderful and special, but it blew my mind that this could even exist. And so that led me to graduate school to learn more about queer South Asian nightlife. And right. I went to graduate school in Chicago. I went to Northwestern University to a performance studies program. And performance studies is a discipline in which we use performance as a way to see the world. So performance doesn't have to be on a stage. It can be what we do on a dance floor. It can be how we dress every day. It can be the rituals we use every day in our life, the way we talk about the everyday in performance studies, we also talk about the every night, that nightlife is this place where people just keep going back to, whether it's the pub or the club or the movie theater or restaurants. Nightlife is this whole place that is, people practice their leisure and they practice their hobbies, and it's not the time of work. But it's also so deeply politicized. You think about curfews, you think about when police do breathalyzers, there's this real surveillance of the night as this dangerous place, that mysterious place, the nighttime is the time of crime. Don't go out at night, right? So there's so much mystery around it. And so performance studies thinks about why is nightlife positioned as this real alternative to the day, and why is that the time that we go out and have fun and do dangerous things or silly things or have dress up or all of those things? So those were questions I was asking in graduate school. But while I was doing that, I also started organizing a queer Bollywood night in Chicago, and I started performing there. That's where I learned that there was also queer nightlife in India. And, I didn't really have much of a relationship to India other than my parents had retired here. So I come here once a year and visit them for a couple of weeks, but I didn't really see much of Bangalore or other than, the mall in their house until I started doing this research and learning about LGBT parties and nightclubs in Bombay, like Voodoo, and all the amazing activism, queer activism and trans activism that happens here. So my research in Chicago brought me to India, and I developed this project that's now a book called Ishtail, Accenting Gay Indian Nightlife.
Yep.
And it's about the movement of music and dance and people across national borders that allow Indian folks to articulate their queerness, not simply in the most global standard of what gay or queer is, but in the way that feels most like home to them.
Right. Absolutely. And when you said Ishtail, I realized my introduction had East Bessel friend, and I wanted to later bring in Ishtail during our conversation. But yes, absolutely. And while I'll let Indu go for the next stab at the question, I have a complaint that your book costs 16,000 rupees in India, which is not fair on Amazon.
I will, I have been working very hard trying to get an Indian edition.
Okay.
And publishers are reticent to publish it because of queer content, because the first line of the book says, "I fucking love drag queens." Huh. And uses a couple of other curse words in the first two sentences. And they said, you know, I don't think our readers can handle this kind of language. And so, you know, and there were also concerns about critiques of Brahmanical patriarchy in the book, that it might upset
fragile male egos
or the government.
Same.
So exactly. So I don't know. I'm happy to get you what all of this. I'm happy to get you or any listeners an e-copy, a PDF copy.
Wow.
If you send me an email.
Yes, please. I will definitely after the show. That is so lovely. Thank you so much. Indigo, at least.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm about empathy, love, and gratitude. So, hi, Karim. I've been reading a lot about you ever since Madhav told us that, you know, we're going to be on this, you know, we're going to meet you on the show. And one thing that really fascinated me is seeing you perform on the stage with the ease and confidence. So as an artist, what's your mindset before you get on the stage and start performing? What is the one thing you look forward to? I'm about empathy,
love, and gratitude. That's a very great question. So I started performing only because I was doing this fundraiser in Chicago and we needed a drag queen and I couldn't find one. And so I just did it myself. And I think I've been performing for about 10 years now. But it was something very new for me then. It wasn't something I did because I wanted to. It was because I did it out of obligation at that time. And over 10 years, I grew it into a craft. And I now teach about it and teach people how to do drag. But I'll say my mindset is, what can I give people? You know, how can I make sure that my performance is a gift to others? Is it to choose a song that I know they'll love and that will bring their energy up, that will recall their nostalgia, that will make them all move together because they all know the dance moves already? Or is it the social critique that I include in the performance that I want to offer people? You know, so it's really, when I'm preparing a performance, I'm trying to think about what is it going to gift to others, as opposed to, oh, I just like this song, or I just want to wear this outfit. So that's the kind of preparation that goes into it, that helps me right before I get on stage feel like I'm doing something good, right? And it's not about charity. It's not about benevolence. It just is like, it just makes me feel a little bit more confident that what I'm doing is not selfish, but that there's some kind of reciprocity to the process of performing. Because I have a lot of fun. I have my good time, but anybody can get on the stage and do what they feel like and have a good time, and the audience may not enjoy it, right? So to me, it's really thinking about, what am I giving others? And asking myself that becomes a way of preparing a performance. And that goes into mixing the music, you know. So maybe I'm using an obscure song, but then I'll throw in something familiar at the beginning or at the end to make a medley, just to invite people in a particular way, right? So those are some of the things I think about when I perform.
That's really interesting. Is there a particular favorite moment when one of your audience came and approached you, maybe after the show, or, you know, your favorite moment interacting with your audience?
Yeah, I think, and this actually, because of this moment, I have a whole chapter on Madhuri and Sridevi in the book because of this moment. But I was performing in Chicago and I was performing Sridevi's Hava Hawaii. And at the end of the performance, this Indian man who didn't, he just happened to be at that bar. He didn't know that it was a Bollywood night. He didn't know there would be a drag show. He just happened to be there that night. And he comes up to me and he says, you know, I didn't know this was happening. And I was sitting in the other room and I heard this song come on and I rushed to see how they were playing Sri Devi in the nightclub. And he says, you know, the last time I heard that song, I was sitting on my grandmother's lap. And, yeah. You know, to me, that is really important that this brown man living in America is able to recall his grandmother inside of a gay nightclub. That and his relationship to his family, because I think, you know, we assume that the nightclub is this like really sexy space and everybody has their shirts off and is making out, and that the gay nightclub as we think of it, you know, in Western terms at least, is like the extreme opposite of the Indian household. Right?
Okay.
But in this moment, this man was able to have that experience, to be there with his hot friends and having his good time and drinking his drinks, and then at the same time think about his grandmother. And how often do we have to get to have moments where those worlds that feel so separate come together? And so, you know, that moment has been really important to me. That also, you know, as a researcher, I think that we often say that the researcher is supposed to just be an unbiased observer.
Yeah.
But actually for me, being a performer has been a way of learning more about what I write about. So, you know, if I was just a fly on the wall and some other drag queen was doing the number, he would go and talk to her, and I would never learn about his experience. But, you know, because I was the performer myself, I actually learned a lot because people wanted to tell me, can I retie your sari? Because it looks horrible. Or can I, or I love that song. Or why did you choose that song and not that song? Or, you know, that's my song. You know, so all of these people telling me what they thought about my performances was actually a way of learning about what they liked or didn't like. And so that became a different way of doing research for me that was a lot of fun.
Quite interesting to know that. You know, when you mentioned, especially about both the worlds intertwining, I think that is something I have never heard before. That
yeah, and
it's special.
You know, and it happens in India when we think about a lot of the gay parties in India, and it differs from city to city, and it differs also from, you know, party organizer to party organizer. But the preference in those parties is for techno music, you know, the kind of music coming out of Goa trance, that because you want to feel like you're part of a global phenomenon when you go to the nightclub, right? And so they play what is seemingly most trendy. So even here, you're not likely to hear a Sri Devi song or a Madhuri song inside of a gay party. It's not just a matter of being in the US, but even here, gayness aligns with the most contemporary, most white or white-coded form of pleasure. And so, you know, even here, it's rare that you get a choli ke piche in the gay party, and it can be a lot of fun when it does, because everybody knows the steps and everybody knows the words and everybody dances together in a different way and can be really sexy.
Right. I'm going to jump in here, Indu. I think I've got a follow-up question on that. So you brought this, you just got a point of comparison of how gay nightlife is in India and the US. Can you, for our listeners and for us as well, I've been to a few gay bars in America. And my first drag show, by the way, Kareem, was in Texas, Houston, when I was joining a ship. And I had a couple of days before I could join it. So I was there in one of the hotels and I just went to a gay bar and it happened to be a a drag show in one of the adjacent bars. So back in 2010 was my first drag show ever. I was about 25. And I can't forget that night. It was such a beautiful day. So can you help explain our listeners what's sort of basic difference in the gay life in America, gay nightlife in America and India? And also, if you can, you've lived in many places in the world, just a little bit, just drops. I mean, probably you don't have to go into details in other countries. I'm about empathy,
love, and gratitude. Sure. So in the U.S., I think the stark difference between the U.S. and India, you know, they both have really fun, interesting, complicated nightlife, gay nightlife scenes. Mm-hmm. But in the U.S., there are gay bars and clubs. They are designated spaces that are always there for LGBT people to come and party. Some of them have cover charges. Some of them are free. Some of them are exclusive to men. Some of them are mixed. Some of them have drag shows. Some don't, you know. But they are establishments. Here in India, there aren't LGBT-specific nightlife spaces.
Nope.
So what you get are a variety of things. One, you get the house party, mm-hmm. that people have events at their home, and they invite 10 people, they invite 50 people. They may have a show, they may not. You know, they might have a little perform, a friend does a performance, or people just hang out and drink and talk and smoke. So you've got the house party,
right.
But someone has to have access to their own personal space,
right.
to do that, right? And so for a lot of people, especially unmarried adults, still live at their parents' home, it's hard. But you have house parties. Two, you have bars that are not gay bars, but LGBT people go there and they squat there and they hang out there. And if the management appreciates the money and isn't too homophobic or transphobic, and it doesn't get out that queer people are there, and it doesn't mm-hmm. get a quote unquote reputation for being a gay bar, then people just hang out there, and it is what it is, and it's sort of known as a gay hangout, but it's not. There's no rainbow flags telling anybody it's there.
Right.
So what happened in Bangalore in the early 2000s was that people, you know, lots of the bars in central Bangalore, you know, were gay hangouts. They would be at one place and then the manager would be like, no, don't come here anymore. And then they'd go find another place and everybody, you know, go there for cheap beers and hang out and flirt and whatnot. And then the manager would realize, oh no, it's too gay, and they'd get kicked out. So there are places like NASA and I think Night Watchmen, and there are a bunch of places in central Bangalore that were known as gay spots, but they weren't marked as such. And then the third is the gay parties that happen in Chennai and in Delhi and Chandigarh and Bombay. So usually in large cities where there mm-hmm. are nightclubs where there are lots of nightclubs, so you can find an empty one, right? Or one that doesn't have a lot of business and say, hey, can we throw a party here once a week?
Right.
And at those parties, you know, the organizers will hire a DJ and will advertise via WhatsApp, maybe a Facebook group, and people can go and dance and drink till whenever the bar allows them to. But they're, you know, they're sporadic. My experience is that they're advertised just the day before or just a couple of days before, because the organizers have to spend the week figuring out, okay, which bar will let us host this party. But you know, so you don't know what your Friday night, your Saturday night plans are until Friday or even Saturday until you get that WhatsApp invitation. But those are sort of the three major forms. And then there are a few other things. There are some dance bars where hijras and transgender women dance.
Right.
There are also hijra birthday parties are huge melas that, especially when it's the guru of a Hijra community, her birthday parties are usually fun and spectacular and all-day events where people are fed and there's dancing and there's shows. So there are all these other ways we can also think about gay nightlife and queer nightlife in India that don't exist at all in the U.S.
Wow, this is so interesting. The last point that you said, I've never heard of it, where the Hijras have their birthday parties celebrated in such a fashion. Very interesting. I would love to go visit one, definitely.
Me too.
Yeah, it sounds definitely fun. Let's further the question. This book that you talk about nightlife and elaborately discuss, I've read a lot of reviews and I get that there's a lot of details and the pros and cons of nightlife and the importance of social connections in these spaces, mm-hmm. which is obviously exploited by a lot of elements in the society in various times. So how does this sort of affect, generally, like you said, social spaces is thought of, or gay nightlife is thought of, people are going to get drunk and smoke and get wasted, but it's also provides a means of social connection and camaraderie and family.
Right.
Can you help our listeners understand the concept of social connections for gay people, and why is it so important to have a nightlife and a safe space for the queer community? I'm about empathy,
love, and gratitude. Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that there's so many answers to this, but one is I'll tell you about one example.
Sure,
in Bangalore, there was a ban on social dance in, I think around 2005 to 2012 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Because of dance bars, there was all this anxiety in the city. And the bars put up a real fight to say, no, we should be allowed to have live music and have dancing. And the police commissioner said, no, nighttime is for sleeping. But the assumption is that, just the working assumption inside of that is you uh-huh. have a family, you have to put the kids to bed,
right?
And then you go to bed because you have to work tomorrow, right? So all just in that one line, those are all the working assumptions
yeah.
about what you're supposed to do at nighttime. Now you think, so it's structured around one, around work, and two, around family. Now you think about a queer single person, what are they supposed to do in at night, right? You think also about someone who is working in call center industries, who actually worked until 10 p.m. and so 10 p.m. is actually their daytime, right?
Right.
So now you think about gay techies or gay call center workers, what are they supposed to do with their night, right? So just the when we think about labor and we think about sexuality together, and that's sort of at the core of the book, when we think about those things together, the world isn't built for our pleasure, our joy, or even our time pass, right?
Right.
And so nightlife spaces become spaces of making community, of finding other people like you, of having fun. They become places where you can make a family or you can find resources. So, even at while sitting in the smoking area of some of these gay parties in Bangalore, I've heard people talking to each other about, hey, I don't like my job, but would your company have any other options? And these are effeminate men who, mm-hmm. Don't have they don't have the same capital of for applying to jobs. So actually making connections with someone who can help them get a job is actually quite important. That kind of networking that says, look, I'm gay, you're gay. Do you like right. where you work? Right. So that exchange of information in these spaces can actually lead to safer work lives for people. And, you know, I've heard horror stories of my friends in Chicago who said, I was abused in my workplaces because I was gay, but I needed that job for my visa, so I couldn't put up a fight. And so having these alternative spaces where you can go to and feel like, okay, it's okay to be like me, is actually really important. So those are some of the things that I think, if we just start to think about how the world is so deeply constructed around the heteronormative family, a man and a woman and kids, and is structured around the very normal workday, we see how many people's lives are actually not compatible with it. And then we start to understand why they make other kinds of networks in which and ways of being together, such as nightlife. But also there are all these other ways people can do it, whether it's book clubs or knitting circles or doing activism together. You know, there are all these other ways of finding people who want to live in the world the way you live in it, as opposed to live in the world the way you're supposed to and the way the government and society wants you to live in it. And that's what I think nightlife does. And that's why I think it's really important. It's just one way of doing it, right?
Absolutely.
There are all kinds of ways of finding community and being with other kinds of weirdos.
No, absolutely. And I think there's another very important point in this conversation that came up, that, you know, it's not only about nightlife has to go get drunk. I mean, drinking per se is so evil in our culture, as considered so such an evil. If you drink, any person who drinks cannot talk about it socially. You cannot talk about it socially in social circles, in office, because the moment you talk about that, I drink, you're considered or you're branded as a drunkard or an alcoholic. I mean, there is no neutral place in for a drinker or for an alcoholic or a person who consumes alcohol. The moment you say you're drinking, that person has a very weird lifestyle. He drinks and you know, parties every night. So drinking is partying and irresponsible. So it's a very illogical connection between all these aspects of life. I think it is so important that we stop criminalizing drinks and you know, people who party, and I think we need to have a more encouraging culture rather than what you just described. You were saying something.
This is the thing around, you know, if you criminalize it, you actually create more problems, right? Because people then have to find dangerous ways to subvert it, as opposed to interacting with it in a more normal way. Right. So if it's dangerous, then you take up riskier habits around it, as opposed to just having a normal social relationship to alcohol. You become dependent on it, or you take larger risks with it. Mm. So if we didn't think of nightlife as a space of vice, then we would make sure that trains and buses ran later, right? And then people could get home rather than fighting with auto rickshaws while they're drunk, right? They wouldn't have to drink so much earlier in order to get to the party and already drunk, right? So there are all these ways that the system, systems and institutions are set up to criminalize alcohol, to turn it into a social problem, as opposed to alcohol and drugs, right? To turn them into a social problem as opposed to something that could actually not do a lot of harm if we had the infrastructure for it, right? And if our infrastructure didn't say, you only have these few hours to have fun.
Absolutely.
So I think, you know, our relationship to work and fun is also really sick and perverse. We're taught to work, 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 and then squeeze a lot into a few hours of fun.
Absolutely.
And I think that that also results in people drinking very heavily, people not knowing how to drink. So this is, you know, being a college professor in the U.S., this is, college campuses are very, very stressed about drinking cultures because the legal drinking age in the U.S. is 21.
Yeah.
And so these people, these young people leave home not knowing how to drink. So what they do is they binge drink, as opposed to saying, have one drink because you like the taste of beer, you like this cocktail. What they do is like, oh, I'm away from my parents for the first time. I've never drank before. Let me chug five beers before I go out. And then they get sick, and then they end up in the hospital, or some, you know, sometimes they die, right? It's really dangerous.
Yeah.
So these systems are in place to create problems as opposed to take care of people. And I think that that's something that we have to acknowledge as we think about this. I think also when you think about gay parties and gay nightlife, are these folks are so uptight, right? They're nervous about going to these spaces, and alcohol helps loosen them up. They're nervous about they're anxious about their sexual attractions, and alcohol helps them say, come into those spaces and say, oh, like, I like you. Can I dance with you? Can we make up, right? So again, if we destigmatized sexuality, then alcohol would actually be drunk only for fun, as opposed to for social lubrication, right?
Absolutely.
And so those are some of the relationships, I think, that, you know, people don't have great relationships to drinking or drugs, don't have safe relationships to those things because they're using them as a band-aid for things that society is not allowing them to deal with well.
I mean, I can't agree with you more, because most of my free time these days goes in understanding the trauma. So my main interest is childhood trauma and addiction, and they're both related, apparently. So addiction is basically a coping mechanism for a troubled lived experience in the past, and which helps in the short term, but is bad for health in the long term. And still that person is unable to give up. And this doesn't have to be alcohol or drugs or cigarettes. It's power, money, everything. Mm-hmm. Without going into the details or the subject, what you said exactly matches, because if you do stop destigmatizing the LGBT culture, people will not be traumatized. The kids, all of us who grow in such tightly knit societies where you're looked down upon for any abnormalities or any, you know, outliers from the normal life, it's just there's something wrong with you, and there is, you know, the way you're looked down upon, the way you're treated, it just adds up to the pressure of the person. And to escape that, people opt drugs, people opt for cigarettes, people opt for something else, something or the other, work, anything, and it's quite dangerous for the society. I think at this point I would like to go away from the book a bit and get to you, because I don't think one episode is enough to do with you to understand the entire book and the work that you do. But I would want to know a little bit about your drag. How do you balance dragging and teaching? Do we say dragging? Is it the right term? I'm sorry.
Sure. Yeah.
How do you balance the two? And when did you do the first time, and how was the reaction, and you know, how do they take it now? I'm about empathy,
love, and gratitude. So to me, you know, when I go to the nightclub, drag queens are the ones who teach me a lot, right? They're the ones who say, make sure you tip your bartender. They're the ones who say, make sure you respect the other folks in the crowd. They're the ones who actually have been performing in that bar over and over and over again. So they know the most about who's in the space. They know who comes every week. They know,
right.
all of these things. So to me, drag queens have always been teachers. So when I once I was doing drag, it made perfect sense to teach as a drag queen. And you know, it's very funny what happens, because my students, they actually jump into it immediately, and they talk about Kareem like he's someone else, and they talk to Lahore or Dr. Vajistan like she is the person in front of them, and they make a clean split. So to me, wow. You know, what's really fun about that is that the classroom is actually a place where we can play in. It doesn't have to, you know, and they talked about the readings, and they talked about what they had learned, and they took it seriously. But it was also, you know, it was fun to play in the classroom. And what that has taught me is that actually every day that I go into a classroom, I'm actually performing.
Yeah.
Because they're actually seeing the costume that I'm wearing, whether I have a beard or dress pants or a kaftan or I'm in full drag. They're actually reading all of those things and deciding things about my gender and the power I hold or don't hold over them. And I think that that's, so drag has taught me a lot about how people see, read us and understand us through our body. And that we're always performing, like I talked about before, whether it's day to day or whether it's on stage. And so that's been sort of my key takeaway from dressing up and performing in the classroom. But it also, as I said, I think reflects the larger culture I write about, where drag artists are really the ones who hold our history and teach us how to be together in the nightclub, and take care of people in the nightclub, I think. And so to me, there's a way that both of those worlds can meet.
Wonderful. That's so. By the way, I'm sorry, I wanted to tell you this. I am hijacking Aditi's questions. Aditi is getting nonstop office calls. And
sure.
She's just running out of the room and coming back. So sorry for that. So I'm hijacking her questions. So I'll go for the next one as well in this one. So a voice, like you were saying, the hold, the power that you hold in a class when you take up or you don't hold. What do you mean in terms of, is it a power, like a feminine power, masculine power, or is it some sort of inner power that comes and drives you to do that? What do you mean by that particular statement which you said?
Sure. I think that, you know, when I walk into the classroom with heavy jewelry and a sari and high heels, and I carry myself in a particular way because that's the way Lahore, you know, carries himself, people treat me very differently.
Right.
And I think it, you know, and if someone walks into a classroom wearing if a man walks into a classroom wearing a full suit, or if a masculine woman walks into a class wearing a full suit, there is this way that class and gender come together to say, yes, you should listen to me. But at the same, you know, so
right.
There's a way we can wield those things to our advantage. But what that also teaches us is that gender and class matter. And they, you know, and they shouldn't, but they are actually always at play. And if we aren't aware of how they're at play, then we actually may not be taking some very smart and important people seriously because of their gender, because of their class position, right? So by switching things up inside of the classroom, I'm also training, I'm training my students and I'm training myself to see that gender is a lens through which they receive information. Class is a lens through which they receive information, and they really have to start disrupting that and listening to, well, what is the reading supposed to say? What is the real takeaway from the class? Not just my professor's cool and fun and interesting. Because, you know, I think we get charmed by money, we get charmed by masculinity, and we get charmed by all these things that media and society have trained us to. And in that way, I think we sometimes lose out on what is most important. So,
right.
So by playing with it in the classroom is a way of disrupting it and shaking things up and saying, what else can we look at? How can we look at the way we learn as opposed to just what we learn?
Very, very strong points. I'm really enjoying this conversation, and I'm just looking at the clock and I'm just getting disappointed. Very interesting point. One last point before I give it to Indu. I think when you were talking about, sadly, the gender and class matters, I believe the masculinity or the femininity as not gender, or I don't think the concepts should exist as genders, as in man or a woman. But I think we all have masculine and feminine aspects in ourselves. And I think the world would be a lot better that if we accept them as an aspect of our lives, and that every one of us have masculinity and femininity within ourselves. And that is what that comes out, irrespective of a woman dressing up as a man or wearing men's clothes and showing that power. That exercise of power should be a masculine or a feminine driven power, not a gender per se. Does mm-hmm. it make sense? Am I making sense?
It makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, what you say, sadly it does. And we all look at people in those two, white or black, in man or a woman, and which sadly doesn't ever exist, which is always a spectrum. And a lot of us get dissolved in it. Sorry.
Right. No, but I think we can say that gender is a construct. Everybody has masculine and feminine, and we should work to sort of dissolve the kind of power that works. But I think at the same time, we also have to spend time studying and understanding how that power works, right? So there's one project is to dismantle gender binaries and gender hierarchies. The other is to understand how is it working in the world? How is masculinity working to uphold caste-based violence in India, right? Because if we're talking about gender only, we actually forget that gender is actually helping other kinds of inequities, and gender inequalities helping other kinds of inequities get even further entrenched. So we have to spend time studying masculinity and the binary way it works, even while we are developing a philosophy and understanding of what the other possibilities are. So men, especially masculine, able-bodied, upper caste men, still have a lot of power, right? And so when other folks are saying abolish gender, abolish the binary, those people who have secured their power so firmly aren't going to let that happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
And will commit such violence in the name of
power,
re-entrenching that masculinity.
Yeah.
Right. So I think we have to be careful in not giving up our study of the binary as part of our project of dismantling it.
Oh yes, definitely. I don't think it's 1 or 2 years of work. It's going to be taking centuries probably to get the toxicity from Indian masculinity, I think.
And I think that's a good point, right? Because masculinity itself doesn't have to be bad, but
exactly.
It is when it is wielded in ways that are toxic, right? And that are used to secure privilege and enact violence on others, that it becomes dangerous.
Hmm. Yeah.
So while we are talking about, you know, why it is important to study about binary so that we understand how to dismantle it. So this is where I would like to know, Karim, your opinion on why representation is really important, because you work in several diverse fields, be it academic or as a drag, you know, when you're dragging or in activism, and even as a, you know, as an artist, how do you think representation really helps, you know, for people to relate and feel included, and why do you think it is important? I'm about empathy,
love, and gratitude. This is a great question, and I might not be giving you the answer that you want, but okay. To me, I think we have to create our own representation, which means I can't wait for Hindi cinema or Kannada cinema or some social influencers to create something that looks like me, because I'm never going to find a Sindhi drag queen professor from Ghana living in the US with family in India on TV. I'm never going to get a version of myself, right? Yeah. That is reflecting my specific queer experience back to me. But I can still learn from other people, right? So I think we have to get out of the idea that representation is going to actually reflect me. Mm-hmm. I think we just need more variety in sort of mainstream media that gives us options. So it doesn't have to reflect me, but it should give us more options. So I think, and it should, so that's what I have to say about representation in the media. But I think the real project is we have to be our own representation. So we have, and that means creativity is what I value most, right? I want to wear a dress, I'm going to wear a dress. I want to wear blue eyeliner, I'm going to wear blue eyeliner. I want to wear a double-breasted blazer with tuxedo pants and dress shoes today. Let me do that, right? And maybe it's not to wear it out on the street. Maybe it's just to take a selfie and send it to my group chat. I don't have to post it online. I don't, you know, but I think that actually we don't have to wait for some famous actor or musician to tell us that we are valid. I think we can actually make that for each other, and we can make it not just for our individual selves, but like I said, the group chat, right? You can make it for those two or three other people to say, look how silly I'm being in my room today. Look at this poem I wrote. Look at this video I made, you know, or you can take it to Instagram or YouTube or whatever. But I think that kind of creativity, people need to give themselves permission to be creative as opposed to waiting for mainstream voices to represent them, because that's going to take a very long time to find the right figure to represent you, you know, because all of those fantastic figures that we may see are also flawed individuals who will at some point get canceled.
True.
And so I think, you know, someone's going to find out, you know, someone, yeah. So all of that said, you know, we can have role models, we can have inspirations, but I think we just need to think of ourselves as creative people, as, you know, and, you know, make your own videos, make your own porn at home, you know, feel sexy on your own terms, feel beautiful, and document it for yourself, whether you write it in a diary or you put it online. But I think that creativity to me is the real antidote to the crisis around feeling isolated, feeling stuck in the binary, feeling lonely.
Yeah, I think that is a very practical answer, you know, rather than waiting for someone to represent who you are, like taking that first step. I think, yeah, that makes total sense.
I mean, I agree with you, Dwir. As in, we've always seen one side of the story, right? Oh, social media is bad. Or if you're posting, that means you're only seeing one side or one part of the story. You're not seeing the other sides. and oh, there is not enough representation in the cinema. Gay people are shown as like this, lesbian, there is no representation. I think with the advent of technology and with the availability and the access to information that we have these days, along with the social media, your point, you've hit the nail on the head by saying that create your own representation. Enough is enough. And why wait for someone else when you have all the means, right?
And there's a blog that I really love called Black Queer. Mm-hmm. And it's by this Black queer man who says, you know, when I'm out at parties, when I'm with people, nobody's saying they want to take a picture of me. No one is telling me I look good. And so I take selfies and I post them online, and a lot of people will say, oh my God, you're so vain. You keep, you know, all you do is post selfies. And what he says is actually, no, I'm learning to find my face beautiful and find my body beautiful by putting it in this medium where people put beautiful things, right? And I'm getting used to seeing my own face in that public world. And now I can think of myself as beautiful by doing this work, right? So I think we have to take stock of what we identify as good or beautiful or attractive, and say we have to, yeah, of course we have to expand those, but we don't have to wait for someone to give us that. We can just do it ourselves.
That is true. When you said about, you know, when everybody should allow themselves the permission to be creative, and I just realized something. I've learned more about the LGBT community by following people who are, you know, who are not always maybe artists or activists, but just normal people who share their life out there on social media.
Right.
I learned more about the community, and I found many friends through the, you know, through social media, because people were just people out there doing what they do best. So I think that will create a much better impact.
And you'll find if you follow influencers, if you follow activists, they're going to say the same thing over and over and over and over again, because, you know, they've been interviewed and they've been asked this question before. And so they'll say the same thing over and over. But these other folks who are not, you know, training themselves to be public figures are actually producing different kinds of content and stories, and like you said, Indu, are telling you, are showing you a different aspect of living this life that isn't necessarily spectacular. It isn't necessarily political. It's quite everyday, but everyday in maybe a slightly different kind of way, right?
Yes.
And I think that that's also really valuable to expanding the field of representation. Not through the most official channels, right, that we deem proper and respectable and authoritative, like myself, a professor, right? But actually through the everyday, right? And I think, you know, this is why I study the everyday, because I think it teaches us a lot more about how the world is working than we're seeing by watching the news or watching TV or these other forms of representation.
True. This is a perspective I've always known, but I just realized during our conversation today.
I love that.
Yeah.
I'm really sorry, but we have to end the show because we have reached the time. But I mean, Kareem, I don't think I am satisfied with this interview. I'm going to have one more and probably
a few more. I'm not satisfied at all.
Yes,
we should do it again, Kareem. You should come again.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So, I ask the guest, whoever comes, if there is something that we have not covered and you wished we covered, before going for the last question.
I'm about empathy, love, and gratitude.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that I guess I didn't say earlier is that when you ask about why nightlife matters, and to think about where we started around the question of sexuality, it's also a place where people go to find lovers and have sex and feel beautiful and sexy and touch and kiss. And I think that, like, again, queer people don't always have access to that. And so that's one of the reasons these spaces matter, is that they are sexual spaces. And I think that We deserve them. We deserve to feel beautiful and sexy and have great erotic lives.
Wow, that's such a cool point. Yeah, absolutely. Feeling good about yourself is one of the most important things in a day, and we don't do it. Almost, I don't know about how it is in the America, but in India, we are so stuck to our daily routines. Wake up in the morning, do a few things, go to office, come back, do a few things, eat and sleep, watch TV, obviously, in the meanwhile. But it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. So many amazing points. Before we leave, one final question, Kareem. What's next? What is your goal?
My goal is to be everyone's auntie. And so I have, my next project is about South Asian aunties in the diaspora, in the subcontinent. Mm-hmm. And I've launched that. So I'm writing my own book down the road, but in the meanwhile, I've launched a website called www.criticalantistudies.com, where people can understand more about why we need to think about aunties, these sexy aunties like Savita Bhavi, or the judgmental aunties, or gossipy aunties, and how and what else they can do for us rather than being a system of surveillance.
Absolutely. I'm going to use that link and put it in the show notes. If the listeners haven't, I mean, all your listeners must have heard about the drag queen life and the drag shows that Kareem has done over a period of years. One particular video of Kareem's is one of my favorites. It was introduced by a common friend, Moses. I think you will all love it. And to end the night, I would all request you to listen to Sari, Not Sorry. And it's one of my favorite videos on YouTube.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing the show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me. And lovely to meet you both as well.
Likewise. And Aditi is as of now on the call. So apologies from our side. Indu, any last points? And Kareem also, any last points, please?
I really, you know, love this conversation. You know, like when you have a podcast schedule at the end of a busy work day, you're not really sure how, you know, in which direction it's going to go. And just to sit back and have this conversation, to hear about Karim's experience, just makes me feel rejuvenated. I don't even feel like I'm at the end of a tired work day. So that is my favorite part about this conversation. Thank you for coming over, Karim.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for saying that.
Thanks. Bye now. Take care.
Bye. Take care. I'm just a